This is Bristol Bay and Beyond for Friday, April 20th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us here on KDLG's weekly news magazine program. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll get an update from Juneau as lawmakers begin to battle out the final details in the home stretch of the legislative session. The high cost of airfare from Anchorage to Dillingham is taking a toll on some local business.
We need some competition out here because these airline tickets are kind of like stifling our economy. People are hurting because you can't get to and from town.
We'll continue our pre-boating season series as Gabe Dunham talks us through some tips on diagnosing a few common motor problems. Plus, some Western Alaska high school students are in Dillingham this weekend for the Regional Music Festival.
Ora pro nobis, ora pro nobis, peccatoribus.
We'll check in with some of these talented young musicians. Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. It was reported this week in Undercurrent News that Copper River Seafoods finalized the purchase of the Naknek processing facility known by many as the Old Baywatch plant. Last year it was owned and operated by Extreme Seafoods. A representative from Copper River Seafoods declined to comment at this time but said a formal announcement was expected soon. The shakeup at the Bristol Bay Regional Seafood Development Association continues as just weeks after Board President Robert Hyeno stepped down, word came that Executive Director Sue Asplin was also leaving. Asplin had taken the helm a year prior after Bob Waldrop retired. Acting Board President Fritz Johnson dismisses criticism that the RSDA is in troubled times.
To the contrary, you know, we're in good shape. The fact that we're having an election and going through some changes, I think, speaks to, what's really a healthy organization. Change is inevitable, and, we will adapt to the times.
The RSDA is looking to fill the executive director position with at least an interim ahead of the fishing season. BBEDC announced they were in the process of awarding 9 of 10 RSW systems purchased for a new grant initiative this year. Regional Fisheries Coordinator Susie Jenkins-Brito says so far BBEDC is pleased with the way the RSW program is going.
One of the big goals of BBEDC is to promote fish quality at the time of harvest. And by offering these RSW systems, that's driving right to our goal.
It took a few years and an act of Congress, but this week the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service officially announced that rural subsistence hunters don't need to purchase federal duck stamps. Changing the law was a big priority for Alaska Native advocates and for Alaska Congressman Don Young, who heralded the news with his own typical flair.
Remember, we had this problem before. Who had a stamp? Who didn't have a stamp? This solves the problem. So I'm real pleased with Fish and Wildlife, and I'm pleased with being able to get this law passed through the Congress.
The new rule exempts rural hunters who are permanent residents of subsistence harvest areas from buying the stamp. In Alaska, hunters still need a current state duck stamp and state hunting license. In our crime and safety beat, state troopers have released no further details on what caused the death of a toddler in Aleknagik last weekend. The 2-year-old boy was found unresponsive Saturday afternoon and, despite resuscitation efforts, was pronounced dead just one day ahead of his 3rd birthday on Easter Sunday. He had no known medical issues. A 21-year-old Nelson Lagoon man was killed when the car he was a passenger in flipped over last Friday afternoon. Elijah Johnson was thrown from the vehicle and killed. Troopers say the driver had been drinking, the car was traveling too fast, and neither were buckled up. A Bethel woman was indicted on a manslaughter charge for allegedly supplying and injecting the heroin that killed her father last September in Anchorage. Authorities say 56-year-old Thomas Tungwanuk died from a mix of heroin and alcohol. His daughter Shannon Cook is being held on $20,000 bail, and she faces up to 20 years in prison. The body of a Kodiak fisherman, missing since February, turned up in Kodiak's St. Paul Harbor Friday night, according to authorities. 27-year-old Mihai Kalugin had last been seen downtown Kodiak early on February 22nd. Authorities are awaiting the results of an autopsy. The criminal case surrounding a brutal attack in Chignik Bay in 2011 came mostly to a close last week when 36-year-old Christopher Jordan of Oregon pleaded guilty to reduced charges. Jordan was one of 3 assailants who attacked a crewman aboard the fishing vessel Alaska Rose. Jordan was given 6 years in prison. The other 2, Daniel Whittington and Lloyd Davis, were convicted at a Naknek trial and are currently serving 7- and 9-year sentences, respectively. And Dillingham police named a suspect in a truck arson case dating to last fall. They allege that 23-year-old Terry Rogers Jr. torched a Ford pickup truck owned by his stepfather after an argument between the two on October 9th. A warrant has been issued for Rogers' arrest. You can find more on this week's news at our website, kdlg.org. There are 9 days left in the first session of Alaska's 29th legislature, and there is much yet to be done as lawmakers wrestle with how to manage $3 to $4 billion in deficits. They're also considering expanding Medicaid, how to move forward with a natural gas pipeline, as well as seating Governor Bill Walker's nominees to top agency posts, boards, and commissions. They have until Sunday the 19th to get it all done, lest they end up in an extended session. Veteran Alaska reporter Rhonda McBride has been covering the political beat in the state's capital for CBS affiliate KTVA-TV, and she is on the program with us now on a rather shaky phone connection from Juneau for this update. Rhonda, thank you so much for joining us here.
Well, it's an interesting time to be talking about politics.
Well, what's the buzz down there? What's happening in this last 9 days?
Well, I think, of course, the legislature's primary responsibility is to pass a budget. And this year, it's just been much more problematic because they face a $4 billion deficit for the current fiscal year, and at least another $3 to $4 billion for the next fiscal year. So they're figuring out how much they can cut to avoid drawing from the state savings account.
Where are they at with the budget today that you're seeing around the Capitol?
Well, right now, the Senate is working on the capital budget. They've already passed an operating budget, both houses. So the capital budget is what's left. And, of course, the Senate Finance Committee has pared it down considerably from the $150 million capital budget that Governor Walker proposed. And basically, the philosophy there is we're only going to spend what we need to match incoming federal dollars. But last night, the Senate Finance Committee did put money back in for the Kivalina School, which they had cut. And, of course, Kivalina very much needs a school because of all of the problems they've had with erosion there. So this is good news for Kivalina.
Now, it seems like there will be some more tension surrounding the whole idea of education funding in the next week ahead here.
That's right. And, you know, education could wind up being one of the bargaining chips. Now, when they passed the operating budget in the Senate, there were cuts to education that sort of surprised everyone. And one was about a $50 million cut in what's known as the base student allocation. That's the per pupil funding formula. And no one was expecting that to happen. So, and that hurt schools substantially. And so there was also some other money that had been cut, forward funding for education. So I think in the very end game here, when a conference committee goes to work on the operating budget, and that's a committee that takes the House version of the operating budget and the Senate version and reconciles them and turns them into one budget. So there's a lot of horse trading going on, and education will probably be one thing that the Democrats push for to restore.
Rhonda, what sense do you get from both sides of the legislature on the governor's plan for Medicaid expansion? Do they like it? Can they work with it?
You know, that is a very good question because, so far, the Republican majority leaders have expressed concerns about Medicaid expansion. You know, they point to the current system, which they say is broken, and they wonder if the system as it is has the capacity, the capability to expand, if it might be even more overwhelmed than it already is. If the state accepts federal Medicaid expansion money, it would get about $145 million to do that, and it would give 40,000 Alaskans, more than that, access to health care, people who are currently uninsured. But, of course, the advocates for Medicaid expansion say that you're not going to see all those people pour into the system all at once. And they also say that some of the problems in the past have been taken care of. But lawmakers on the skeptical side of Medicaid expansion have a lot of questions about how this would go forward.
We've seen kind of with the gas line proposals that are there that there's some tension between Governor Walker and the Republican leadership. How's he getting along politically this session, the governor?
Well, I think, you know, it was destined to be a challenge for him in a number of ways because he ran as an independent. And so they're not used to dealing with sort of a bipartisan administration with a lieutenant governor that's a Democrat. And a lot of Democrats have been put in power, as well as Republicans. But I think it's a structure that they're not used to. And then on top of that, the governor immediately coming into office had to deal with what was then projected to be a $3.5 billion budget gap. And now it's grown to closer to $4 billion. So the governor, you know, did not have the opportunity at the beginning of his administration to do a lot of the organizational things that a governor would normally do. So I think he was, you know, focused on the budget, which he had to be. But I think that that is sort of the beginning of the troubles because I think the legislature, after coming off of 6 years with Sean Parnell, were very used to having an executive who was on top of things and proactive. And of course, Sean Parnell had been a state legislator himself, so he was very familiar with the process and how to work with the legislature. And for Bill Walker, doesn't have that background.
Rhonda, do you see any problems ahead for any of the governor's nominations to some of his top posts, maybe specifically along with his attorney general designee Craig Richards?
Well, I think that Craig Richards' appointment is problematic. I've heard Republican majority leaders say they believe he's qualified, but they are unhappy with some of his career history, the fact that he, you know, has been successful in winning lawsuits against oil companies, and I think that they're troubled by that. Now, recently, the Attorney General filed an amicus brief, signed Alaska on with an effort to ban gay marriage. And so I don't know if that will help him with conservative lawmakers. I know that it's angered the gay community. And the Democratic Senate caucus had a meeting yesterday. They were concerned about the decision, and some wonder if that may cost him votes among Democrats.
Well, much to get done in the week ahead. What's your sense on getting out on time?
Well, everybody says they want to get out on time, but I, you know, all for the last month, everybody's been predicting a special session. If they don't get Medicaid expansion taken care of by next Sunday, you know, it's possible the governor could call them back for an extended session to continue meeting. You know, we'll just have to see what happens with that.
Rhonda McBride is the Juneau correspondent for KTVA-TV. Rhonda, thank you so much for joining us and for this update.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for staying with us on KDLG's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Visiting students from four Western Alaska towns made their way into Dillingham for the Regional Music Festival this weekend. Young musicians have been tightening their bows and cleaning out their spit valves as they prepare for their performances and a chance to go to state competition. KDLG's Matt Martin brings us this report.
Students fiddle with guitars and pianos in the high school music room as others paint large pieces of paper.
Okay, so fold the corners down to the right line. I put an X over the wrong line on each one.
Music director Shannon Spring helps his music students prepare signs to welcome the visiting schools to the festival this weekend. Spring has been planning this event for the better part of a year.
It's been a mountain of work and quite stressful.
Students are coming from Nome, Kotzebue, Unalakleet, and Bethel. Spring has had to coordinate with each of those schools to bring this festival together.
Did they have all of their music? Do they have flight arrangements? What instruments are they going to bring?
But you can't always plan the weather. The snow on Wednesday night prevented the visiting schools from getting in as planned. The concert for Thursday had to be canceled, but the concert tonight and Saturday are rolling on as planned. One of the biggest aspects of the festival is the solo performance. students audition with a solo performance for a spot at the state competition in Anchorage.
So the students are working really hard as individuals on those solos is what they perform.
One Dillingham student with her eyes towards state is freshman Sue Lee.
It's called Prelude Op 2815 Raindrop, and I like how it's like has like a calming sound. It's like really nice and slow.
Lee got interested in playing piano when she was about 6 after watching her older brother play. She remembers wanting to be like him.
And I started like trying to copy him and everything, and then my parents decided put me into piano lessons.
She then started lessons with Shirley Williams. She says she fell in love with the sound of the piano.
I can just get a song and I can just start learning it and I can just start performing and just playing.
She says she would like to make it to state and she's going to try hard, but she also realizes this is only her first year auditioning.
I'm really nervous and I think that I should be kind of like looking out because there's a lot of good people, like good pianists out there.
In addition to the solo performances, the full bands from each school will be performing. Each band will have the opportunity to play pieces they've worked on all year, and then all 150 students from every school will play a concert together on Saturday evening.
It's fun to see gifted students being challenged and put on the spot because they typically sound really good.
Band director Shannon Spring is looking forward to hear the hard work of all the visiting students. He says he always gets excited to hear the pieces they've chosen to play.
And then, of course, I'm most excited to hear how my students do.
As opposed to the strict competition of a basketball tournament, a rivalry between two opposing teams, music festivals are about perfecting your craft as an artist. The fiercest competition this weekend will be between a young artist and the notes on a page.
Pretty Woman, all the way through one time. If you get lost, get found.
In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
Okay, ready?
The cost of getting from Dillingham to Anchorage is a common topic of conversation around town, and often a sore one at that. Penn Air has had scheduled service connecting Anchorage and Dillingham since the mid-80s, a point which CEO Danny Siebert touted at a meeting in Dillingham in February. But the ticket prices keep climbing, and the ripple effects threaten Dillingham's status as a hub community. Consider that upriver travelers now use direct charter and grocery service from Dynina Air Taxi, and Togiak travelers now often use Raven to connect to Bethel rather than Dillingham. Losing hub traffic can mean losing local business. Joining me now to talk about the effects of this is Dan Boyd, who runs a raft and camping equipment rental company out of Dillingham. Boyd caters to travelers from around the world who come to float and fish some of Western Alaska's signature rivers, which many consider among the premier destinations on the planet. Dan Boyd, thanks for coming on the program.
Yeah.
These are the trips of lifetimes for people.
Yes, they are. We have people that have dreamed about coming up here to Dillingham, to the wilds of Alaska, and this is a once-in-a-lifetime deal for them. But we have a number of individuals that have come up every year. They've made it a get together with the boys and go to Alaska and do our 6 to 10 day float trip and just have a good time.
What are some of the most popular rivers you put people on every year?
Okay, our most popular rivers are the Good News, the Kinnick-Tock, and the Togiak Rivers.
And how many years have you been running this business?
I started doing this in 1992.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
Now, the reason we asked you here is to discuss how these airline prices that are outside of your control are affecting your business?
What we've known, okay, this is how it's gone. Even during the down years when the economy tanked around 2007, we still had a pretty good clientele that would come up here and, like you say, do their once-in-a-lifetime trip or do their regular trip. So we've had a pretty steady clientele, but since about 2010, we started seeing a trend where our bookings started to drop off. And I had actually clients call and tell me, said, you know what it is, Dan, it's nothing to do with how you guys treat us out there in Dillingham. We think that the town is great. The air taxis that we work with are great. Your equipment's great. But when we go to look at prices to get to Dillingham, and we know that we can fly clear across country, you know, on flyer miles and get deals, you know, we can fly clear across the country for $600-$700, and then we have to pay that last stretch from Anchorage to Dillingham, you know, around the $600 range, and sometimes it's as much as $680. So that hurts. And then, on top of that, when you get here, you don't have your luggage. You don't have your fishing poles. You don't have half of your gear. And then you wind up having to do a layover day or delay your trip, you know, by a day or so until you get your gear and you panic.
Is that a frequent occurrence?
That's a frequent summertime occurrence. That's a frequent summertime occurrence.
You said to me earlier that what you're noticing is people are flying to Bethel and starting their trips from there.
Yeah. Our clients started telling us a number of years ago. They said, Dan, we can fly to Bethel, Alaska, way cheaper than we can fly to Dillingham, Alaska, and do the same rivers from the Bethel side. And you can't argue with them. For instance, the same $650 ticket or $600 plus ticket that you're going to pay for in the peak time from June through August, everyday prices to Bethel, Alaska on either Alaska Airlines or Raven Air are $250 round trip. $250 round trip tickets. And when you're talking about a group of people, a group of guys that are anywhere from 6 to 9 and sometimes as large as 14 people, and you're going to be paying, you know, a third of the amount of money going to Bethel, you're going to be saving a lot of money. And so that's what they've been doing, is booking their trips and going out of Bethel. So we've been losing on the Dillingham side. The B&Bs have been losing. Their rentals are going down. Our bookings are going down, and that affects the stores, because when these guys go out to do their float trips for 6, 8, 10 days, and the Europeans usually like to do a 14-day trip, they'll go to the stores and spend over $1,000 in supplies, you know, food and that type of thing for their trip.
What do our local float plane operators tell you that you work with?
Well, they know the same thing.
Also losing business.
Yeah, also losing business, because those are the people I work with. We've only got several air taxis that do the float plane operations. But anyway, yeah, Mr. Siebert was in town here a while back talking about how he was comfortable with his prices that he charges for a round trip from here to Anchorage. And he said he was comfortable with his price. He thought his price was fair.
I don't think that's sat well with a lot of folks, but you're saying not especially with your industry.
Oh, especially with my industry. You know, it's to me, it's like kind of like gouging in a way. I mean, he's got a captive market. There's no competition, and that's the thing that we want to get out, is that.
What's the solution? What could
we
be
need?
Done?
We need competition.
Do you see any on the horizon?
There has been competition that has come into town before, but they haven't been able to stay long enough to build up a steady clientele. But when they do come into town, as you will know, as people do know, Pan Air will drop his prices to compete against them. We've had Frontier Airlines come in and try for, I think it was for a little over a year, maybe they tried to do the Dillingham market. But we need maybe Raven Air to come back in or something along those lines to give Pan Air some competition to lower our prices, because these airline tickets are kind of like stifling our economy. People are hurting because you can't get to and from town.
Last question, and maybe to put it into perspective, how are your bookings looking for 2015 here?
Oh, in 2014, they were probably down over half. They were down over half, and this year is going to be about the same or maybe even a little less than last year. So it's not looking to be a good season at all.
Dan Boyd, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Over the past 2 weeks on this program, we've been discussing some maintenance tips on taking care of outboard motors. Our guest for this has been Gabe Dunham, the Marine Advisory Program agent in Bristol Bay and a seasoned marine mechanic. In the first part of our series, we put together a basic toolkit to keep on board. Last week, Gabe walked us through a preseason maintenance check, and this week, it's time to attend to a few, certainly not all, of some problems encountered while underway. Gabe, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Let's talk about diagnosing some problems on the water.
Sounds good. I like to start with a diagnosis procedure that I like to think of as the systems-based diagnostic procedure, and that's to just simply approach problems with engines in respect to their systems. And we're talking about the fuel system, the spark or electrical system, and the mechanical system. Now, each one of those systems is required to be operating for the engine to run in general. So when you encounter a problem with an engine, it's best to try to narrow down the symptoms and assign them to which system you think is causing the problem.
Let's start with the problem.
All right.
You're on the water and the motor stops.
Sure, this is maybe one of the most disappointing problems because you're obviously on the water and you're probably not on land, so it can also carry with it some safety implications as well. The first thing I always think of when the engine stops is to check the easy stuff first.
You're out of gas.
You're either out of gas or the kill switch got wrapped around your ankle and you moved your foot and pulled it out or something like that. So I would check those two. When it comes to checking the fuel, the first thing I'm going to go to is the Raycor. I'm going to check and see if there is fuel in the bottom of that Raycor bowl. Specifically, I'm also going to check if the liquid in the bottom of the Raycor is water, because as we know, engines can't run on water, and water in the fuel will cause the same situation for the engine to stop while it's running. The last thing I would check is to make sure that the engine is turning over freely. And you're probably going to be able to verify this when you try to start your motor again and it either cranks over or it doesn't. Because as I mentioned before, the mechanical system of the engine is also one of those required systems to make the whole engine run.
Okay, you've gotten to the fishing spot and cast a few lines and you go to turn the motor back on and it won't turn over. I think everybody's heard that or been in that spot at least a few times.
Yep, that's true. We probably have. And it's important here to differentiate between the engine not turning over and the engine not starting, because those are two separate problems that need to be diagnosed differently. For an engine that won't turn over, the first thing I'm going to check is whether or not the other accessories in my boat are working. And that's going to tell me whether or not I'm getting battery voltage to the boat in general. The next thing I'm going to check is to make sure that my gear shifter is in neutral, because it's really easy to make a mistake, and most engines won't start when they're in gear. So I would check that as well. If I don't have any voltage going to the boat, I would go to the battery connections and check for corrosion or loose connections or maybe a broken battery lead. And if I check all those things and the engine still won't crank, I'll probably try to start the engine using my handy rope pull starter that I keep in my boat box.
Which was in, right, yeah. Part one of our series.
Yeah, right.
All right. Okay, so there's won't crank, but how about you're turning the key and it just won't start?
This one can get tricky too. And now we're gonna go back to our systems-based diagnosis here. We're gonna look at each of these: the electrical system, the fuel system, the mechanical system again. If I'm turning an engine over and it won't start, the first thing I'm probably gonna want to check is whether or not it's got fuel. I'm gonna check and make sure that when I pump up the primer bulb gets tight. I'm going to make sure that the choke is working properly. You can usually, while activating the choke, you can listen for that click underneath the cowling. And, of course, I'm going to check for potential water in the fuel system too. The next thing I'm going to check is to see if the, again, similar to our first situation, I'm going to check and see if the kill switch has been pulled out, if that safety lanyard is there. And finally, I'm also going to evaluate what I'm doing to start the engine and make sure that I haven't either flooded the engine or misguessed the amount of choke that the engine needs to start.
What are some tips to starting? I think everybody may know their motor, but let's say you're on somebody else's boat and you need to get that started. What are some good tricks to the right choke and the right procedure to starting?
Well, if you've got a fuel-injected motor, typically you want to leave the throttle all the way closed and just crank it. It'll start up and the computer will control everything that needs to be done on its own. If you've got an older motor with a carburetor and a choke system, the typical starting procedure is to, when the engine's completely cold, give it full choke, advance the throttle a little bit, and then crank it until the engine catches, and then give it a little bit less choke as the engine is starting to warm up.
What if you think you've floated the motor?
Well, if you think you've floated the motor, the best thing to do is advance the throttle, don't choke the engine, and crank the engine over until you hear it try to start. What you're doing there is you're taking all the excess fuel that's inside the engine, which is what happens when the engine's flooded, and you're pushing it out and displacing it with air.
All right. All good, handy steps, Gabe. I appreciate you walking us through the diagnosis. Gabe, thanks so much.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Dave.
And we'll post that three-part series along with some handy worksheets Gabe printed up by next week at our website, kdlg.org. That's it for this week's Bristol Band Beyond, our weekly news magazine heard Fridays on KDLG. We welcome and encourage your feedback and story ideas. Email them to news@kdlg.org. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. We hope to see you back here next week. Before we go, we'll leave you with some more music from some talented young musicians visiting Dillingham this weekend.
My name is Jaden Oten, and I'm from the Nome Belts High School, and I'm an alto.
My name is James Jorgensen. I'm a senior from Nome Belts High School, and I'm a tenor too.
I am Alyssa Bushy, and I am a soprano too.
One, two.
Ave Maria, gratia plena, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus. Toribus, nous est in hora.